Here on FM, we continue our Book of the Week, Mary Portas' autobiography, Shop Girl. 10 months since Mary's mum died, her father is beginning to emerge from his grief. But his new romance will have serious consequences for the rest of the family.
What does he think he looks like?
My big sister Tish cries as she walks over to the buffet table. We're standing in the Working Men's Club in Watford. Dad has got a deal on hiring it for my 18th. He is wearing brown flared trousers and a cream and brown striped shirt. His hair is slicked to his head with about 3 pots of Brill Cream. Night fever is playing. Our father suddenly can't get enough of disco. My brothers and I watch in horror as he jives across the dance floor.
Oh, make him stop!
I wail. But he is having fun. And it is good to see him smile at last. Since Mum died 10 months ago, he's been lost in his sadness, sitting crying for days in the front room, not talking to any of us. Now he seems to be emerging from his grief. It had started when my sister's boyfriend Phil told us about the Widows and Widowers Club in West Watford that his mum went to each Saturday night. We persuaded Dad to give the club a go, and he arrived home so happy after one too many pale ales that he fell off his chair in the living room as he told us about the night. Oh, great music, lots of people. Oh, lovely to have a wee dance. We had no idea just how much fun he was having, though, until we went to visit him in hospital following a long-awaited operation on his piles and found a very attractive woman called Bernadette sitting by his bed. Bernadette didn't last long, but my father didn't seem too worried. He suddenly had a new horizon and was going to make the most of it. I just wished he wasn't doing it quite so publicly. On a cool September morning, I walk into the local college, where the faint tang of bleach hangs in the air. Someone had dropped out at the last minute, and I'd been offered a place on a graphics with visual merchandising course. In other words, shop windows. I certainly didn't want to work in a shop for the rest of my life. But the college was local, and since Mum had died, I needed to stay close to home to look after my dad and my little brother. It was the only kind of way out that I could hope for right now. Never underestimate the power of polystyrene. Mr. Lawrence was in charge of teaching us about creating signage and props. We put them into mocked-up shop windows every Friday, and the rest of the week was spent working towards that moment. One week we'd do a soup display, the next china and towels, kitchenware, then followed by Grand Marnier. So what are you going to put in your window tomorrow? A girl called Tracy asked me as we queued in the canteen for a coffee. She had crashed onto the scene in a blaze of peroxide, red lips and ripped T-shirts. My windows were going to be based on Blondie's parallel lines. I was besotted with her. The insouciance, the disdain, the girl with a one of the boys attitude. My brother Joe had bleached and blunt-chopped my hair, and I'd started tie-dyeing my jeans on the sly in the photography darkroom at the college during my lunch breaks. Our windows tomorrow had to be about music, and I was planning to paint mine with black and white lines, like a zebra crossing, a mannequin sprayed white with a single black line covering its eyes would stand in the corner next to her albums, suspended in a zigzag across the window. Tracy, meanwhile, was theming her window around YMCA. Hardly innovative music, I thought. I was scathingly superior. Grief had found the perfect outlet in disdain for everyone and everything around me at college. with ash-blonde hair teased so much that it looks like a crash helmet, my father's new girlfriend looks like a hybrid of Mrs. Slocum and Barbara Cartland. She's wearing a cream skirt suit, pearl earrings, and her face is barely visible under a thick layer of foundation. "Hello, dears," she says, in a voice clipped somewhere between Brickett Wood and St. Albans, as she walks into the front room. The five of us have been called to attend Saturday afternoon tea. Sitting in a line on the sofa and living room chairs, we watch as Dad wedges his hand firmly in the small of Rebecca's back as she lowers herself slowly into the swivel chair.
"Oh, I'll make a pot of tea then, shall I, sweetheart?"
Dad says, and bolts out of the room. The clock ticks. The canary starts to sing. Rebecca bites delicately into a yellow French fancy. Wearing blue eyeshadow and red lipstick, she looks like a giant mouse in drag, nibbling cheese. I think of the delicate stroke of coral lipstick that Mum used to wear. We stare at each other as she takes a sip of tea. I wonder how long it will take for her to go the way of Bernadette. But that doesn't happen. My father starts to wash his own underpants, putting them in a pot and bringing them to the boil on the cooker with a handful of Dad's. He's bought a pair of slip-on shoes and is out so much that we can go days without seeing him properly. On weekends, he visits Rebecca. I have filled my Friday windows with tins of Campbell's soup, bottles of Brut, cases of Lieffraumilch, hung 6-foot lengths of fuchsia, red and orange paper from the ceiling, and torn rips in it through which peep China products. I have woven strands of wool like a giant's cat's cradle and suspended bottles of perfume in them like baubles on a Christmas tree. I've dreamt up ideas for kitchenware and sports clothing, bathroom accessories and lighting, baking products, soap and back-to-school stationery. The rest of the week passes me by. Walking into college in the morning, I wait for the moment when I can leave again. I sit in lectures on retail commerce and art history, thinking about what jobs I need to do at home. My sister Tish and I, and all my brothers, sit wordlessly in the living room, listening to raised voices in the kitchen. My dad has just announced that he wants to make a new life together with Rebecca, alone. So, he's going to sell the house, and we all need to find somewhere else to live. My Auntie Kathy is furious.
"What are you thinking? You can't just up and leave them. Where will they go? What will they do?"
My father replies that we are adults, and it's time for us to make our own way.
"But Mary is still studying. And Lawrence is only 16 and hasn't even left school."
But Dad does not budge. The kids do not need him, he says. "I am 18 now. Lawrence will soon have left school and can join the police cadets. It's a good career. He needs the money from the house in order to move with Rebecca. He's worked hard enough for it."
"Be that as it may, what you're doing is wrong. And I, for one, am not going to sit by and say nothing."
Dad roars that he'd thank her to keep her opinions to herself. The door to the kitchen is wrenched open, and we hear Auntie Kathy's steps in the hallway. The front door slams, and then there is silence. I feel ashamed. I don't want anyone to know what is happening. Surely people will think that we must have done something to deserve this. Because if not, what kind of father makes his own children homeless? It's the smell that hits me first as I walk through the doors of Harvey Nichols. A blend of sweet leather and perfume, plus the sharp tang of starch. I know what I am smelling. money. I'm here on my work experience from college, working on their 22-strong display team. My colleagues were made up of a mixture of understatedly chic men who talked in a voice honed by private school, and screaming queens whose barbs and histrionic mood swings were delivered with razor-sharp wit. These men were exotic to me. Huge storefront windows had to be filled to entice passers-by inside, and as I stared at them at the end of the day, I suddenly glimpsed the possibility that college might offer for the first time. Sitting in a lecture, I'd heard that Salvador Dali had designed windows. So had Andy Warhol. Now I understood why. These windows were art, drama, a fantasy landscape where anything could be played out. A performance. They were a stage, and through them, the audience of passers-by were transported, just as they were when they watched a play. If I could work somewhere like this, I wanted to do it. Everything was changing as the 1970s drew to a close. The winter of discontent saw Margaret Thatcher swept to power and Sid Vicious overdose in a blaze of publicity. Earl Mountbatten was blown up off the coast of Ireland, and a killer, dubbed the Yorkshire Ripper, terrorised women. But time was suspended in my family home at Windsor Road as we waited to see what would happen with the house and where we would go. Dad stayed more and more at Rebecca's after the estate agent's board went up, coming home only to drop off some money for food and give me a bag of his washing. He'd look nervously around before leaving again. My father's wedding is quiet, very civilised. Rebecca is a Seventh-day Adventist, and suddenly Dad is one too. Even so, he's wearing the best suit in church, silver-grey mohair. He's always known how to dress. The reception, just a quiet lunch, is held at the Noak Hotel in St. Albans. We silently chew our way through prawn cocktail, silverside beef and pavlova before walking outside to wave off the newlyweds. When the gear stick on Dad's car breaks and he has to phone a taxi, Rebecca's face sets in a rictus grin as they wait for it to take them away to their new life. We are all adjusting to new beginnings. The house has finally been sold. I'm staying with my parents' friends Sheila and Harry for now. The only things of Mum's that I have taken are her statue of St. Therese of the Roses and the Marguerite Patton cookery book. Otherwise, Dad has all her things at the new home in Dunstable that he's now sharing with Rebecca. The last traces of our life together have gone. But something shifts inside me as I watch the taxi putter down the drive. There'll be no more hoping that Dad might come through. No more arguing with him about money, the house, or his responsibilities to us. He has made his choice, and we are on our own. I feel free.
Mary Portis was reading from her autobiography, Shop Girl. It was abridged by Joe Coombs and produced by Hannah Marshall and was a Loftus production for BBC Radio 4. Tomorrow, Mary starts to build a new, independent life, but the troubles in her family continue. Coming up after the news, Woman's Hour.
This lady is making her face funny for money this Red Nose Day.
Hello, I'm Alex Jones. Let's get started.
Pink hair is always a winner, even nostril hair.
A bit of purple on the eyes.
There are many ways you can raise money, like asking your work colleagues to put in a fiver for a funniest face contest. The funniest face gets a prize and Comic Relief gets all the cash.
Ooh, that looks nice. Lovely.
I'm not sure the cream cheese is such a good idea.
Nah. What do you think? Too much? Too much?
Excellent stuff.
Aw, thanks, Lenny.
For lots of ways you can make your face funny for money this Red Nose Day, and to get your free fundraising kit, go to bbc.co.uk/rednoseday.